Crowther, Editor-in-Chief of Total Film, and I've got with me on this festive podcast online entertainment editor Jack Shepherd.
Hello.
Hello, Merry Christmas, Jack.
Merry Christmas.
And our news editor, Jordan Farley.
Merry Christmas.
Oh my goodness, Jordan is...
That was much better, wasn't
it? But Jordan's been in the sherry.
I'm infected with the Christmas spirit.
Yeah,
I'm full of mince pies.
Yeah, we have our mince pies here, and we've got our wine, and we've got our cake from Tom Cruise that he sent us for Christmas, which is very nice.
The tastiest cake I've ever eaten in my life.
It really was the best cake. And we need to put it in the freezer, I think, and just
save it for special
in
occasions.
Increments. Yeah.
Yes, thank you, real life Tom Cruise. For the
real life Tom Cruise. Okay, so we're nearly at the end of 2019, which has featured some highly rated and highly slated releases. We've been transfixed by trips to the moon. We saw smart female-led comedies, both period and modern. And we had a delightful whodunit, and we saw the return of some cinematic masters. But there was also The Hustle and other unmentionables. So if you've got your mince pies and your tipple ready, boys, let's take a look at the hits and misses of another year where escapism at the cinema seemed like a better bet than reality. Let's begin with our countdown. So here's our top 20 countdown of the best films of 2019 that you should have seen, as voted for by the critics and staff of Total Film. So here's 20 to 11. At number 20, Toy Story 4. 19, Star Wars The Rise of Skywalker. 18, The Souvenir. 17, Beats. 16, Us. 15, John Wick 3. 14, Burning. 13, Little Women. 12, Minding the Gap. And at number 11, Knives Out. So we're glossing over that section of the top 20, but you can read more about it in the current issue of Total Film, which is on sale now. But we're going to talk about the top 10, so let's get started with this at number 10.
What can you tell us about the Lima Project?
Its objective was to search for advanced extraterrestrial life. The ship disappeared approximately 16 years into the mission.
And the commander was?
He was my father, sir.
This might come as quite a shock to you. Your father was experimenting with a highly classified material that could threaten our entire solar system. All life would be destroyed. We're counting on you to find out what's happening out there.
So that was Ad Astra. Jack, you love that film.
I do.
Why?
I thought it was great.
Why is it got a worthy place in our top 10?
Well, I think it probably should have been called Dad Astra. Because it's basically Brad Pitt with major daddy issues. He's left behind by his father on Earth, and then they find a signal somewhere out in space, and then he goes to travel to this mysterious signal who he believes to be his dad. It's like a loose promise. We're not sure if it's him. We're not sure what it is. And Brad Pitt is just so good in this. His performance is magnetic. It's all from his perspective, and James Gray directs it with real panache.
It's beautiful looking.
It's
stunning.
Yeah, absolutely stunning. I mean, it kind of takes the iconography of something like 2001, similar kind of spaceships. The blackness of space is so apparent and scary in many ways, but there's also quite a lot of hope in the film as well. It's told very earnestly. I just really, really love it. I think it was so much... not fun. It's not the paciest film of all time, but it kind of, you linger on it, and I was thinking about it for so long afterwards. I think it was really beautiful.
I think it does what a lot of great sci-fi films do, in that it balances, the cosmic scope of a journey into the dark heart of space.
Yeah.
With a very intimate story about a son trying to reconnect with his father, which is no easy feat.
No, I think that's kind of what it comes down to, is the father-son dynamic of it, where you kind of can get lost in space in some of these films, but then there's a real heart to it as well. And I think that's what acts as the core to this film. I mean, the reason we love Star Wars and, well, the original trilogy, is because there is the heart of all the characters, and there's that familiar connection as well. And with this film, it's kind of the same. It's not like an action romp, even though there are parts of that in there when there's like a pirate chase.
There's a great chase sequence, like Fury Road in space or something.
Yeah, exactly. So that's why I really love Ad Astra, and that's probably why it made our top 10.
Great. Let's move on to number 9.
Did you just look at me?
Look at me! How dare you! Close your eyes!
I could not just stand by and let you destroy me.
You are enjoying life. nervous, aren't you?
Oh, it is fun to be queen sometimes.
So The Favourite, this was one from very early on in the year, and it was in last year's awards conversation, but it's made our top 10 because it has that sort of, it's so unique, I think. We hadn't seen anything like this before when it came along. It's so witty, weird, fisheye lensed, three really strong female leads. It's about a proper historical moment, yet... Again, it's that whole thing of the large of that historical moment with the actual small of the human dynamics and the emotional sort of cost of three women going at each other in court. The costumes were amazing. The performances were great. The comedy was just so weird and delicious. Mm. I absolutely loved watching this, probably because often when you see a film set in this era, it's about the men and what the men are doing in court. And this was about the women, you know, sleeping with each other, counting their rabbits, vomiting in pots, doing all the stuff that they were doing in this film. It was great. Did you enjoy it?
Yeah, I really enjoyed it. As you say, it's such a funny one, though, because it came out so early in the year. Mm. I almost don't think of it as a 2019 film. But yeah, it probably is one of my favourite films of the year. The favourite, yeah. Not the favourite, no. But one of the favourites. Yeah.
Definitely one of my favourites. I think, whose performance did you prefer, though? Because I know there's most people would pick Olivia Colman, and she's kind of the shining one. I really like Emma Stone in it. I think she's probably my highlight. I think she's just so great as the one who turns everything on its head as well, and the kind of like conniving,
increasingly
person.
Ruthless.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I think her performance is amazing.
Yeah, I really like Rachel Weisz as well. She fits that kind of ice queen figure quite well.
Yeah, and it also, you know, serves her well to show what she might do in Black Widow, because we don't know what she's going to do in that, but she's very commanding in this one. Mm. So moving on to number 8.
Christian says you've got this special week planned.
It's sort of a crazy festival. Special ceremonies and dressing up.
That sounds fun.
Unbelievable.
Welcome and happy Midsummer. Skål!
So that was Midsummer, the most horrific breakup movie ever seen. It's quite a difficult watch.
Oh, yeah. Incredibly difficult, not least because it's a 2.5 hour horror film, which is no easy thing to sit through, even when it's a breeze. But when you're seeing, you know, people jump off cliffs and people's heads split open, it becomes quite relentless and grueling. But I thought this was exceptional. Ari Aster, obviously quite a new director, made Hereditary last year, which for my money is one of the best horror films of the last 10 years. And this is an equally sort of daring and ambitious follow-up. Takes its cues from The Wicker Man to a certain extent. It's about Florence Pugh's character who goes to a midsummer festival in Sweden, and it doesn't go as she expects it to.
No, not at all.
It's very messed up. But one of the most striking things about it is it's a horror film set almost entirely in daylight, which you basically never see. And is very, almost even more unsettling.
And very pretty. People are going around with flowers in their hair.
Beautifully shot.
Gorgeous little white outfits, and yet stoving each other's heads in with mallets and burning people to death in buildings.
Yeah. It's a very satisfying film to watch because all the men in this film behave like absolute twats.
Absolutely.
And let's just say they get their comeuppance.
Yes.
Yeah, if you've recently been through a breakup, this is the movie for you.
It's very cathartic.
Yeah, cathartic.
But I mean, and also the thing is with this one is you could read anything you like into it. I mean, I feel like the things that happen in the film don't actually happen. Mm. It's just an emotional trip for Florence Pugh's character who's taken drugs and is having this emotional breakdown. And this is just her entire sort of state being played out in her mind. But, you know, you can watch it as just exactly that. This is actually happening. You could read into it all sorts of things, and that's always the mark of a good film if you can take away from it whatever you desire.
Yeah. I mean, for me, it was more of an exploration of grief than anything.
Yeah.
Much like Hereditary, but almost to greater depths.
I know it's long, but our colleague Jamie Graham also has seen the director's cut, which is like an extra half hour as well. And I think,
what does it have more of? Bears?
I don't know if there are more bears. I know there's more torture.
More torture.
Yeah, and a lot of the scenes are extended as well. They kind of go on a bit longer to amp up the
creepiness. I don't know that
creepiness.
I've got it in me to see more of those scenes because I had toothache coming out of this film from sort of clenching my jaw so hard because it was so terrifying to watch.
Yeah, I'm not sure if I really want to sit through it again anytime soon. But yeah. Not that I didn't enjoy it. I really, really enjoyed it. But it's the same way with Hereditary. Like, I don't want to put myself through that. It's terrifying. So they're both two films that have given me nightmares, and probably the only two films in the last like 5 years that have done that. So, yeah.
Ari Aster's tapping into your subconscious.
He is. So if you want to have a really horrendous Christmas, watch Midsommar now.
Okay. Good tip. Thanks, Jack. So let's move on to number 7, which is this little number.
We have to go to a party tonight.
What?
Nobody knows that we are fun. We didn't party because we wanted to focus on school and get into good colleges.
And it worked.
But the irresponsible people who partied also got into those colleges.
I'm incredible at hand jobs, but I also got a 1560 on the SATs.
So that was Booksmart, directed by Olivia Wilde, which is about two bookish girls who decide to have one night of fun when they discover that their fellow pupils at school have got into the same colleges as them without relinquishing any of their social life.
Yeah.
It's such a fun film. I loved this. And I just thought it was an amazing debut by Olivia Wilde, who's directed some Red Hot Chili Peppers music videos before and a couple of shorts, but this was, you know, her first feature film, and it was so assured, so clever, and so kind. Another one of those films. We'll be talking about another one later in the list that I also think is a kind film about school. What did you think of Booksmart? Did you enjoy it?
I enjoyed Nerds Gone Wild for sure. It was, it felt like it's kind of in the same league as Superbad in that way, where it's like the dorky kids finally have like a great night out. But it's done in such a fun way where you're completely engaged the whole time as well throughout it. And the places where the characters go and what they learn along the way and stuff is all feels quite resonant. Maybe because I was a nerd myself as well. And so it's just like, yeah.
Was Jack.
Was, still completely am. Thanks,
we're all
James.
Nerds here. Yes. Come on.
There's no nerd shaming at this podcast.
I just loved Caitlin Dever and Beanie Feldstein in this. I thought they were just so good. They were so well cast. And you totally believed them as like childhood lifelong BFFs who would just do anything for each other.
And also that this was the romance in this, although there was sort of romantic entanglements with other people, was really the love story between these two friends.
Precisely,
You know, usually a high school comedy is about getting the guy or getting the girl. Yeah. And this was about staying friends with the girl you've been friends with your whole life and making sure that that friendship continues, even if you go to different colleges and you don't see each other for a while. And I think anyone can relate to that idea of how hard it is to sort of maintain those friendships of the people that you've grown up with and only known, and you're embarking on this whole new life. I just thought it was universal in that way and so touching in a way.
So wholesome.
But it's not wholesome, is it? Because there's a lot of dick jokes and masturbation jokes and drug taking and, you know, all sorts of things that are R-rated and very amusing, and a great soundtrack as well.
Mm. Yeah, I feel like it's the perfect film for like 17-year-old, 16-year-old sleepovers.
Yeah.
Kind of when everyone thinks they're going to watch a slightly naughty film and put it on, and then everyone's just going to be giggling along. It's going to be a real cult classic, I reckon.
Yeah.
People didn't go to see it in the cinemas en masse, but I think
it will find its audience.
It will definitely find its audience.
And that's why it's on our top 10 as well, because it has reinvented the wheel, which is the high school teenage comedy. And also, we think it's going to go for the long haul.
Deserves to.
Yeah. Okay, let's move on to number 6.
Hey guys, it's Kayla back with another video. So, the topic of today's video is being yourself. Being yourself can be hard. And it's like, aren't I always being myself? And yeah, for sure. But being yourself is like not changing yourself to impress someone else. A lot of people like call me quiet or shy or whatever, but I'm not quiet.
Most quiet, Kayla Day.
I don't talk a lot at school, but if people talk to me and stuff, they'd find out that I'm like really funny and cool and talkative.
By the way, I like your shirt a lot. It's like so cool.
What?
Okay, moving on to number 6, which is 8th Grade. Jordan, you and I absolutely love this film. Why?
Yeah, this is my personal number 2 of the year. And it was very close to number 1. But this is an exceptional debut from Bo Burnham, YouTuber turned filmmaker. It's about 13-year-old Kayla Day, who's a middle school student. And at the start of the film, we see her. She's a sort of YouTuber, and she talks about self-help ideas.
Not a very good one, though. Nobody's watching those.
Precisely. No one's watching it. But she speaks very eloquently about, you know, growing and maturing. But then in high school, in quote-unquote real life, she is introverted. She's shy. At the start of the film, she gets an award for being the most quiet student. So it's basically a coming-of-ager about a girl with anxiety and social anxiety issues. But it's very much speaks to modern concerns and modern mental health issues.
Yeah.
I think this is probably the first sort of high school / middle school film that's dealt with modern illnesses like that. And it does it so sensitively. And you can't believe that this has been written and directed by a 27-year-old man when it seems so authentic to the experience of a 13-year-old girl in America. Elsie Fisher is just, she's an absolute star in this. She's a firecracker. She's so lovable and warm.
Yeah, she's delightful.
You just want to give her a big hug.
Yeah.
And tell her
and
it'll be all
you
right.
You know, it's important to say there's not a film that you have to be a 13-year-old girl to enjoy.
No, absolutely
it's
not.
It's another one of those that anyone can understand the feelings that she's going through, or her dad, who plays a big role in the film.
Yeah, I think it hits hard because even though, I mean, I grew up with MySpace and stuff, social media has been such a big part, and it's growing in such a huge part of young people's lives from the ages of, you know, 11, 12, when people now get Facebook. And this is one of the first films, as Jordan said, to explore that idea. You know, they message each other through Instagram in eighth grade, which is quite funny because I guess if I was making this film, I would have gone, they would message through like WhatsApp or Facebook. But Bo Burnham, I was reading an interview and he was like, well, I spoke to some young people and they were like, we don't use that. We use Instagram now.
Yeah.
Which is, I don't know, it's so funny that that's like, this is one of the first movies to do that. And it's really interesting take. I mean, it fills me with huge anxiety for the future because there are going to be so many people like this girl who are trying to get out there on YouTube and are just putting stuff out into the void and putting themselves out there.
Yeah.
And then they get, I don't know, like 10 people watching or something.
But at the same time, it's not bleak, though. There is hope in this film. And this is, you know, this is the other film I was talking about with that sort of that kindness running through it, that it is very, it's about knowing yourself, being kind to yourself and allowing yourself to make mistakes and being assured in that, whether you're a parent or a child. It's a lovely, lovely film.
Yeah, it's one of the year's best, definitely.
Let's move on to number 5.
My mother always tells me to smile and put on a happy face. She told me I had a purpose. To bring laughter and joy to the world. Is it just me? Or is it getting crazier out there?
Smile, though your heart is aching, smile.
That is Joker, which caused some controversy when it came out earlier this year.
Just a little.
Just a tiny bit. There was all sorts of discussion about it, inciting riots and catering to incel folk and women blaming. I, as a woman, enjoyed this film. I thought it was amazing to see Joaquin Phoenix play this sort of sad, depressed man who lives with his mother, Arthur Fleck, in 80s New York, struggling to get by with this terrible condition he has where he involuntarily laughs and his greatest ambition is to be a comedian and there's no bloody way he's ever going to be a comedian. We know that, he doesn't, and it's sort of about his downfall as he sort of discovers that the world is a cruel place and there isn't really a place for him where he wants to be as he is. Did you like this film? Did you think it was going to incite riots?
I didn't think it was going to incite riots at all. I think that was a bit of a snobby opinion from certain critics, but I like that it was divisive in just people liking it or not. I think that's just what bracing art is supposed to do and should do. It's supposed to make you feel things, and some people it's not going to connect with. I mean, me personally, it wasn't necessarily my favorite film of the year, but I completely get it, and I can see why the rest of Total Film absolutely love it, because it is so shocking. It kind of pulls on those Scorsese strings as well, in a way that just really works and makes it its own thing as well. And I think it takes the superhero genre in a completely new direction. I think people who see this and then they're going to want something different from Marvel and DC in the future now. This has set a new...
It's raised the bar.
It's completely raised the bar. I think looking to the future of film as well, the fact that it's the first R-rated film to make over $1 billion, it's going to change the way people make movies, hopefully using... We're in the age of IPs and using those. So hopefully franchises will start taking risks, because this was a risk. And I think it paid
huge
off.
Huge risk.
Yeah. This was one of the biggest surprises of the year for me, because a Joker origin story directed by Todd Phillips does not sound appealing.
Yeah, the man who did The Hangover is going to take the clown prince.
And the idea of a Joker origin story just isn't something I wanted before this film. But I think they did a remarkable job with it. Not least Joaquin Phoenix, who for me gives the best performance of the year in this film.
I mean, there's no justice if he's not in the Oscars circle.
Yeah, I mean, he's got some tough competition from an actor we're about to talk about.
Yes.
In a certain film we're about to talk about. But he deserves accolades, certainly.
And like we were saying about Eighth Grade, it's just really interesting to see something like mental health really explored in a very sympathetic and easily understandable way to understand how a man like this might feel, what challenges he might be living with, and what is making up that sort of psyche that he becomes, ultimately blooms into this horrific Joker figure, and why that might have happened.
And not only that, but to make it politically relevant as well, to make his growth or downfall, should we say, part of the failings of modern society and modern healthcare institutions that failed this person. I think that was quite a daring and challenging thing to do.
Yeah, and our current sort of lack of community is quite Gotham-like, perhaps. It's a cracking film. Okay, let's move on to number 4.
And when to leave me alone.
I thought we should talk.
Okay. I don't know how to start. And your love is growing
cold. Okay, so this is Marriage Story, starring Adam Driver and Scarlett Johansson. Jack, you loved this.
I did. It's so heartbreaking in many ways, but absolutely enthralling. You know, you've got Scarlett Johansson and Adam Driver giving these two incredible performances at the center of it, backed up by people like Laura Dern. So the two main characters are going through a divorce. They want custody over their kid. Adam Driver wants to continue directing in New York, but then Scarlett Johansson is moving to LA with the child and she's trying to take him there, and then suddenly got fights over custody, over lawyers they're trying to work with, and it all leads to this incredible heated confrontation between the two of them where a wall gets punched and it's just so fantastic.
A meme gets born.
Meme is born. And then, you know, you've got another amazing scene with Adam Driver singing in a karaoke bar. And
a Stephen Sondheim song.
Yeah, and it's just so good. I think Noah Baumbach's done an incredible thing with the direction of the film, managing to balance both characters. I mean, one of the ongoing debates around it is, does it side more with Adam Driver's character or Scarlett Johansson's? I mean, I'd say perhaps slightly Adam Driver's character, but then other people have argued that it sides more with Scarlett Johansson's. I think actually he's done a really good job at balancing the two of them, and it's hard to pick a side in any way. But I think the conflict between the two of them is just amazing.
It's the second great breakup movie of the year after Midsommar.
Okay, it's a little bit different from that then.
I don't know, it was just as stressful for me.
Yeah, it's a hard watch, but there's also a lot of love there as well, because it doesn't skimp on showing why these people were together, what they did love about each other, and the sort of clinical nature of divorce. And how even people with the best intentions, I mean, they go into this divorce intending to be amicable. And just that sort of process chips away at that, even the friendship they have, until they absolutely loathe each other. And then they have to sort of start at ground zero and build something again. It's sort of fascinating to watch human interaction like that. and the fact that people do weird and strange things and, you know, cut off their noses to spite their face. You know, there's an amazing scene when Adam Driver's character takes his child unwillingly trick-or-treating in a rubbish outfit around a neighbourhood where nobody's answering the door because he wants that time with his kid. And there's such truth in it. Everything you watch in this, you feel like that is absolutely what would happen. Yeah. I just thought it was amazing writing.
And for me, it was ultimately an optimistic film by the end, because it's about how love changes. Like, their love doesn't die, it just turns into something else.
Mm.
I thought that was quite a heartwarming message to leave the cinema with after, you know, 2 hours of absolute trauma and screaming. Yeah.
And it also puts you off divorce.
Yeah.
And possibly marriage.
Yeah. I mean, divorce and marriage both sound awful now.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
No thanks.
Okay.
Do we think that Adam Driver is going to win the Oscar for this? He has to be the favourite at the moment, right?
He's so good in it. And, you know, he's been so good in other things this year as well.
He had a great year.
That he would be the front runner for me, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Scarlett Johansson as well. Definitely front runner for Best Actress, surely.
Yeah. She's the best she's been since Lost in Translation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think. Okay. So that's why that is in our top 10. Let's move on to our number 3, which is a little teeny tiny film.
Even if there's a small chance, we owe this to everyone who's not in this room to try.
We will. Whatever it takes. Whatever it takes.
Whatever it takes.
Whatever it takes.
So that was Avengers Endgame. Ah, oh. Jordan, this is your time. Come on. Why is this at number 3?
Well, I think Kevin Feige and Marvel Studios had a Herculean task in front of them, creating a satisfying resolution to a decade of Marvel films. And they pretty much do it flawlessly in Endgame. I can't imagine anyone leaving Endgame and going, that was very disappointing. It's just, as a resolution to all those films, all those character arcs, it pretty much delivers on every level. It's incredibly satisfying fan service wise.
Mm-hmm.
Whoever you love, you probably get in a moment where you're jumping up and down in your seat. I'm a Captain America fan, so
yeah, we know.
Everyone's seen it now, so I presume we can talk about spoilers.
We
but
can.
If you haven't, maybe skip ahead 2 minutes.
Yes.
But, you know, Cap wielding Mjolnir in the final fight was pretty much the highlight of my year.
Yeah.
/ life.
Yeah.
And is a moment I will never forget. It just felt like they really delivered on everything that they'd promised in terms of creating a universe and creating a world. Which is a remarkable achievement.
Yeah, especially when now we're post Rise of Skywalker.
Mm.
You can see how
difficult that is.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You know, the culmination of these mega franchises is not an easy thing.
Mm.
This year there was Game of Thrones that ended as well in controversy, Rise of Skywalker now in controversy, and then Endgame, it satisfied nearly everyone.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know anyone who went, oh, I feel really disappointed by that film. But
mm-hmm.
even though the promise of Infinity War was so huge.
Yeah.
They nailed it. I think you're right in saying that every character got their, you know, was done justice. I would say perhaps not so much Black Widow.
Mm.
I think
she's got her own film coming.
She does. Yeah. I do wonder how much of that. I mean, I don't mind what she does in Endgame, again, skirting around spoilers, even though everyone in the world has seen this film at this point. But
no, her hair's not great.
What?
That's nitpicking, isn't it?
Yes.
Oh,
I liked her hair.
Okay.
But yeah, she has got another story coming out next year, so maybe they thought
that's when
we can properly focus on that character.
Yeah.
Okay, great. What has beaten Avengers then? What is at number 2?
Frank, I want you to meet my cousin, Russell Bufalino.
Better watch. There's a lot of tough guys around here. Did he tell you? You're not afraid of tough guys, are you?
Yeah.
I didn't think so.
Well, that is The Irishman by Mr. Martin Scorsese. Jack, why has this massively long film got our number two spot?
Just because it's long doesn't mean anything. I mean, it's...
People have complained about this, though.
I know.
Having to watch it in segments or, like, needing to wear, like, a tenor lady or something.
Yeah, I feel perhaps slightly biased because I saw it in the cinema, as I think quite a few of us did. And it does make sure that you're sat there and watching it the whole time without the ability to pause. I mean, I didn't even go to the toilet in it.
Well, that's good to know, and I'm sure everybody listening will be pleased to hear that.
I know, because it's so good, and you don't want to miss a single moment. I thought it absolutely whizzed by. Every single scene was just pacey. The dialogue was so much fun, completely bouncing between the characters. I mean, Robert De Niro in it is incredible. I think he's so good. The CGI was pretty seamless. There are a couple of little bits around the eyes.
Shaky moments at the start, definitely.
Mainly toward when they really got very young. But I think when he was in his mid-40s and then getting a bit older, it was really good. I mean, talking about De Niro, you've got to talk about the other two major performances in it.
Joe Pesci.
Joe Pesci is the standout for me. I think he is so good. He's playing, you know, that wise gangster character, which we've never seen him play before. Normally, he's the kind of like uppity,
the jittery,
jumpy.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And he's still so scary, though. He barely says the words.
Malevolent, isn't he? Even though he's sort of saying, "How are you doing? You know, have you got sorted out?" And it's just like, oh,
yeah.
I wouldn't want him to ask me to his dinner table anytime soon.
Yeah. I mean, like that line, which has also become a slight meme, they're like, it is what it is.
It is what it is.
You know, terrifying, really. You know, they managed to create this character who's godfather-like and put him in this film. And again, the de-aging stuff didn't put me off him. And I think he's definitely a front runner for the Oscar supporting actor. Also, Al Pacino, amazing in this as Jimmy Hoffa, doing some really great stuff. I mean, he's the leader of the Teamsters, and seeing him go from kind of being really in control and then not so in control as well behind the scenes, kind of asking Robert De Niro's character for advice and things, it's really great. I mean,
I'd also say, you know, Stephen Graham is amazing in this.
Yes. Stephen Graham is amazing shorts.
His amazing shorts, yeah. Yes. They are quite the Eiffel, aren't they?
Flamingo pink or
they're
something.
They're very she-she, aren't they? Very she-she shorts. Try saying that after more than one sherry. I think he's really great, you know, throwing ice cream at Al Pacino, but also this whole scene, and this is the thing about Scorsese films, there's always a scene where people reenact it, like, you know, like, am I funny? You know, how am I funny?
Funny how, funny ha-ha, funny peculiar.
And there's this one in this, which is all about timekeeping. This, you know, not being late. It was such a good scene in this film. And for my money, that's why I go and see this film, just for that scene. Because it's pure Scorsese magic, that the way it's filmed, the set design, the way it sort of builds up to this sort of crescendo of violence. And it's also weirdly funny. I loved it.
Yeah. And you've also got the last 40 minutes, which I know you really enjoyed, Jordan.
Yeah, the last 40 minutes too. An hour were really what made it for me, because, you know, we've seen Scorsese do gangster films multiple times before. You could see this as part of a thematic trilogy with Goodfellas and Casino. But the last 40 minutes is something we've never seen Scorsese do before, which is muse on aging and death and what happens to these figures when they age out of their profession.
Mm-hmm.
What do they do with their lives? They go nowhere. They're alienated from everyone around them. They've effectively thrown away their life for nothing. And it's quite a powerful final act for that reason, because it's really, you can read Goodfellas and go, it's romanticizing the gangster life, because look what they've got. They've got great cars, they've got great apartments, mm-hmm. they've got beautiful wives.
But the front seat at the Copacabana.
Precisely. But in this, I don't think anyone could watch that film and go, I want that life.
That kind of hasn't really been seen that much on film either. The only place I can really think about is in the TV show The Sopranos, when they do touch on that aging gangster who actually life's a bit shit in the end.
Yeah.
And this is, it feels like a really mature step. I say mature for Scorsese, but like, yeah, you know.
That young spring chicken, Marty.
Yeah. But it feels like a natural evolution for someone who is the master of cinema. And this is just, you know, I think in the Total Film Review, it's called a Twilight masterpiece, his Twilight masterpiece. And that is completely correct. I think it's my personal number one film of the year. But then the team decided that something else was number one.
Shall we find out what that is? Come, do me a drum roll. Very good, very good. Stop. It is this.
All right, what's the matter, partner? It's official, old buddy. Well, it has been. August night and
the leaves hanging down and the grass on the ground. Here I am, flat on my ass. And who I got living next door to me?
I'm Sharon Tate. I'm in the movie.
You're in this?
That's me. I play Miss Carlson, the Klutz. It's a ragged
tent where there ain't no tree. Charlie's gonna dig you. And that gospel group.
So that is Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, Quentin Tarantino's ninth film. How has this made the top spot? What is it about it that makes it our number one this year?
It's just a really good film, isn't it?
That's that.
That's it. That's it. Wrapped up. Done.
Sorted.
Come on. No,
it's great. It's Tarantino very much. He's always had a love for cinema. He's always had a love for Hollywood. And this is him really in his wheelhouse. You can tell the passion is really there with this film. It's about, you know, the shift from the golden age of Hollywood, TV westerns, all that kind of stuff, into the post-Manson Hollywood when everything changed, basically. And it's a period that he romanticizes and reminisces about, and it's almost infectious in the way it makes you love this period in Hollywood and in America. He does it through the lens of a slightly over-the-hill TV actor played by Leonardo DiCaprio and his stuntman played by Brad Pitt. And it's a day-in-the-life kind of story. It's a hangout movie. So you really get to wallow in their lives. You really get to immerse yourselves in what it's like on set for Leo's character, how aimless Brad Pitt's life is in this film. And then you're
just like fixing TV antennas.
Aerials, picking up hitchhikers.
Yeah.
And then doing slightly more interesting things like going to Spahn Ranch, where if anyone knows their Manson history, they will know that that's where the Manson family hung out for a while. As well, you have Margot Robbie, who's playing Sharon Tate in this film, who floats ethereally through it. And again, if anyone's aware of the true story of Sharon Tate, they will know that her story ended tragically and that the film is potentially building to that fate as well, but take some unexpected turns and quite moving turns. This is one that I wouldn't want to spoil just in case anyone hasn't seen it yet. But I absolutely loved what he did at the end of the film, and it really made this film work for me. It felt like a similar to what he did with Inglourious Basterds, but with more of a heart and more of a purpose. And it felt like a tribute to Sharon Tate and a kind of cinematic fairy tale that really moved me.
You're right about the ending. It feels like a release of, you know, a cathartic release, because at the beginning, for the first hour or so, it is very lethargic in its pacing. You know, it's just a lot of people kind of driving around to cool music and stuff. But then suddenly you've got this last third where it explodes, and it's just, I loved it. I think I had a grin on my face the whole time. I think some people haven't enjoyed the ending so much, but
yeah, it's been very divisive.
The ending for me is pure Tarantino. It's him at his best, playing with what we know and just using the characters he's created in such a fun way, because they are the main duo. The blokes are so good. But also what's so fun is that it does feel like the actors should be playing them the other way around. It feels like Leo should be the stuntman and Brad would normally be the leading actor in a Western. But Tarantino's kind of playing with that in his casting as well. I mean, Brad Pitt's amazing in this. I think he's the highlight for me.
He's had a good year.
Yeah, and his dog. Let's not forget his dog.
Oh, Brandy. How could we forget Brandy the dog?
A star in
Scene
her own
stealer.
Right. Yes.
Yeah. Eats raccoon-flavoured food. What's not to love?
Absolutely. What is not to love?
And it's also, you know, like you're saying, that you feel like you're in this world. The production design on this is amazing. Recreating Hollywood in 1969 is just flawless. And they drive around the block and, you know, they've changed all the signs, and it's just, it really does feel like a weird sort of, like you're inside a dream or something.
Yeah.
It is really good at evoking that sort of era.
Yeah.
I think, you know, talking about the driving round, I know it can feel slow paced, but at the same time, it feels kind of like American Graffiti, where you're just enjoying the ride and just looking out and seeing this world that he's created. Because Tarantino, you can tell he just adores it. He must have loved every second of just working on this film. And you feel that while watching it. I think it's hard not to, if you love film and you love film of the era especially, not to be enveloped by that and just to love it as well. And I think that's why it's particularly been a hit with our team, because everyone's a film lover.
And cinephile.
And yeah, exactly. And this is a movie for cinephiles, just made with a gigantic budget.
And some violence.
And if you've only seen it once, I'd say it's a film that really benefits from a second watch, because you don't have that queasy tension about what he's going to do with the ending the second time round.
Yeah.
You can just kind of luxuriate in it and enjoy it more.
And hang out with the characters more.
Exactly. And that's what he wants. It's almost bizarre that you spend your first viewing experience almost clenched up, wondering where is this going, because the rest of the film isn't that.
Yeah. Well, that is our number one, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Hey, you're Rick Dalton. Don't you forget it.
So let's recap our top 10. At 10, Ad Astra. At 9, The Favourite. At 8, Midsommar. At 7, Booksmart. At 6, Eighth Grade. At number 5, Joker. 4 is Marriage Story. 3 is Avengers Endgame. At number 2, The Irishman. And at number 1, our crowning glory, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. So that's our great movies, but now to the opposite end of the spectrum. Jack, we need a rundown of our top 10 turkeys for this year.
So, a couple of clunkers this year.
Clunkers.
Yeah, to go along with your Christmas turkey, here are a couple of turkeys. These are going from worst to even worse.
Worst to even worse. Let's go.
At number 10, we've got Rise of the Foot Soldier, Marbella. The fourth installment in the Rise of the Foot Soldier series.
Did anyone want that?
No, I didn't.
I didn't.
I mean, I was calling out for it.
Were you? It was made for you.
Yeah, it was made for me. I mean, the other three had 1-star reviews in total film. I mean, it's funnily enough, number 4 did too.
It's consistent, at least.
Consistent, exactly.
Okay.
So number 9, there's Destination Wedding with Winona Ryder and Keanu Reeves.
Which is so bizarre and frankly insulting. I don't understand what was happening in it.
It's the only blot on the year of Keanu.
Yeah. Keanu was great this year, and then he made this.
I think we just need to ignore that in Keanu's filmography.
We'll erase it. It hasn't happened.
Exactly. Moving on to number 8, X-Men Dark Phoenix, the final installment in the X-Men series.
Not rising from the ashes.
Yeah, the series went down in flames.
Ba-dum.
Ba-dum-bum-tsh. Which is such a shame, because I really love the first few X-Men films.
Yeah,
and now
they're great. I mean, yeah, Days of Future Past, fantastic, but... Was anyone asking for another Dark Phoenix film?
And a recreation of The Last Stand again.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Shame.
At number 7, Men in Black International.
So sad about this, because like with those people and that combo which we loved in Thor Ragnarok, why did this not work? It was so boring.
Where did the chemistry go?
What happened?
At number 6, Bel Canto with Julianne Moore.
She made two films, one of which was good and the other was this.
Mean, but fair. And number 5, The Queen's Corgi.
The only animated kids film this year with a Trump joke in it.
Children love a Trump joke.
They do.
They love politics.
They love political humour.
Yeah.
And Jack Whitehall, apparently.
Mm-hmm.
At number 4, we've got not Hustlers, but The Hustle.
Yeah, insulting and stupid. And not to be confused with Hustlers with J-Lo.
Whatever you do, do not watch this on a plane instead of Hustlers.
Yeah, don't get it wrong. It's going to be disappointing if you thought you were going to get J-Lo stripping in Rhinestone and you got this, which is Anne Hathaway and Rebel Wilson doing a redo of
Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, a significantly better film.
And number 3, we have Night Hunter, Henry Cavill in this film.
Oh, Henry.
Half decent cast, but completely wasted.
You've also got Ben Kingsley in this.
Yeah, Alexander Daddario.
How do these people not have better pickers for scripts and stuff?
Yeah.
You think they would pay an army of people to choose good
they
films?
They do.
For them? Especially when you got like Superman money. And then you end up in Night Hunter. Also a terrible name for a film. Anyway, number 2, we have Hellboy. So this is not Guillermo del Toro's one, but the one featuring David Harbour of Stranger Things as the titular Hellboy.
Yeah. I mean, what the hell were they thinking?
It was hell.
Just inept on every level, basically. Yeah. David Harbour was okay, just about got away with it, but he's surrounded by just terrible accents and terrible everything.
Hellish. And at number 1, we have Serenity from Stephen Knight, the writer, creator of Peaky Blinders.
Yeah. With Anne Hathaway.
With Anne
Hathaway. In her second entry in this list.
And Matthew McConaughey.
Yeah.
This has got arguably the worst twist I've ever seen in a film.
Yeah, the twist is insane.
Mm.
I don't want to give it away.
Yeah, just because it is if you're watching it, it's almost got that room, the room quality to it.
Yeah.
Where you're like, this film is so terrible, I can enjoy it because it's so bad.
Yeah.
So maybe people will actually watch it and find it fun.
When the twist comes, you will be laughing. It's hard not to laugh when something's done this sincerely, but this badly. So that's our top 10 turkeys of the year.
Mm. And we didn't even mention Cats. Nobody's seen it yet, but it could be in there.
Cats could be in there. I mean, we've heard...
Yeah, the trailer should be in the top 10.
The trailer could be in the top 10. We know multiple people have seen it. Our reviewer has seen it. It didn't quite get the one-star treatment.
But it's weird.
But it's very weird. I mean, Tom Hooper finished it the day it premiered. He was working on it for 36 hours before that. So,
I mean, digital fur technology requires a lot of work.
I know, but what are you going to do? If they're coughing up that many hairballs, it's going to take that long.
Oh, Jack, I think it's time to move on.
Too much sherry.
You've drunk too much sherry and eaten too many mince pies, and I think it's time to get the cheese board in. So let us know if you agreed with our list or if we missed something. You can let us know on Twitter, @TotalFilm. And as always, don't forget, there's a 10% off Total Film subscriptions with the code INSIDETF at checkout at www.myfavouritemagazines.com. .co.uk. Okay, cheers to you all, and we hope you have a great new year. And if you want a taster of what next year is going to look like at the pictures, grab the current issue of Total Film, which features a massive preview of everything in 2020, and it's on the shelf right now with a cover of Birds of Prey. You can't miss it. It's Margot Robbie dressed up with a baseball bat. She looks great. We'll be back in the new year with a new podcast and all of those films to look forward to. But for now, we're going to pop open the champagne and we're off. So say goodbye, boys.
Bye. Have a happy new year.
What Jack said.
Yeah, thanks very much. And we'll see you in the new year.